Hi, Alvin. Welcome to the Big Unlock podcast. And it is a pleasure to have you on board here. As you might be aware, this was started by my colleague, Paddy Padmanabhan from Demo Consulting. And we are building upon what he left us as his legacy. So I'll just mention that I'm Rohit Mahajan. I'm the managing partner and CEO at BigRio and Demo Consulting. And I'm also the host of the Big Unlock podcast here.
Rohit, thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I'm excited about a lot of the interesting topics we will be chatting about today. So yes, happy to give you an introduction and give you some sense of where I came from and what I'm interested in. Once again, my name is Alvin Liu. I was born and raised in Hong Kong. I came to the US as a teenager to attend a boarding school in New Hampshire. And afterwards, I did most of my schooling on the East Coast. I'm a practicing retinal surgeon. I did my ophthalmology residency training and retinal fellowship at Johns Hopkins Medicine. And afterwards, I stayed on as faculty. I'm actively practicing. I take care of patients with a variety of retinal problems. And outside of my clinical work at Hopkins, I am completely focused in artificial intelligence in several different areas. So within Johns Hopkins Medicine, I wear several different hats. First, I'm the inaugural director of the Gills AI Center at the Wilmer Eye Institute. And this is the first endowed AI center at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, made possible by a very generous donation of $10 million by Dr. Gills. Second, I'm a clinician scientist, so I have been involved in the development of clinical AI tools. Third, in the past few years, my focus has been in the implementation of AI tools for both clinical and operational purposes on a health system level. And I'm sure later today, we're going to dive a little bit more into the specific examples. And fourth, it's in AI governance. So as you can imagine, there are many things happening in the realm of AI in healthcare. And in response to that, Johns Hopkins Medicine recently established a leadership team that has oversight over everything AI related across the entire health system. And I'm on this leadership team. So I will be very happy to talk about some of the AI governance work that we are doing at Johns Hopkins.
That's amazing. Alvin, I wonder with so many responsibilities, how do you even find some time? Do you sleep at all?
I do sleep. I do try to get 7 to 8 hours sleep every day. And I think that's extremely important because I myself cannot think very well if I don't get enough sleep. So I do put a premium on the amount of sleep that I end up getting.
That's amazing. So tell us, Alvin, that you studied here on the East Coast and you're a practicing physician. So what attracted you to the technology, especially the new technology, and when did you get involved with it? And talk with us about some of the work that you have done in this area. And even before that, if you would like to talk about the health system itself and the geography and the kind of patient population that it serves, feel free to do that as well.
Sure. I can start talking about how I got involved in AI to begin with.
Yes.
So near the end of my clinical training, that's around 2017 and 2018, that's when I first got started in artificial intelligence. And that's around a time when a specific kind of AI technique called deep learning first came about. As you know, deep learning really is the underlying architecture and technique that runs everything AI related in 2025. Deep learning is very good at two things. One is in image or video analysis. And the second, more recently, in the form of large language models, in natural language processing. Back in 2018 or so, the vast majority of deep learning application in healthcare was in image analysis. Yes. And being a retina specialist myself, we really are at the forefront of images, because if you look across the different medical specialties, radiology and ophthalmology are the ones that are the most image intensive, both in terms of research and clinical care. So that's why if you look at the amount of AI research and also real-world AI implementation, the two medical fields that are at the forefront in the US and around the world right now in 2025 are indeed radiology and ophthalmology.
That's amazing.
The specific example that really got me interested in the application of deep learning in ophthalmology and more broadly medicine was a study that was published by Google a few years ago showing that you can train an AI model to predict someone's age, sex, and blood pressure, smoking status, just by looking at a retinal photograph. And obviously, that's a superhuman capability. No doctors in the world will be able to do that. And it's that one particular paper that really convinced me that AI, as we know it, will change medicine and society as we know. And that's something that I want to dedicate the rest of my life to.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So tell us a little bit more, Alvin, about the Johns Hopkins and as the organization itself and the kind of patient population that you serve. And then, of course, we can dive into really some use cases that you are seeing there and kind of in the midst of.
I will start off by giving a sense of what Johns Hopkins Medicine is about. And then, as you suggested, we can dive a little bit deeper into specific examples. Mm-hmm. So Johns Hopkins Medicine is headquartered in Baltimore, Maryland, and is an integrated health system. We operate 6 hospitals and around 50 outpatient sites. So that's where we are. We serve a wide range of patients, the majority of which are urban residents. And we've been doing a variety of different AI initiatives in the past several years. And I'll give you 2 specific examples. Yes. So the first example is a clinical one. It's the deployment of autonomous AI for diabetic retinopathy screening. And we started doing this in 2020. This is an interesting application because when this application was first approved by the FDA back in 2018, it was the first ever fully autonomous AI system in any medical field that was approved by the FDA. So literally, my field, retina, was the first. That's and made history. Mm-hmm. And then there was a relatively recent study that was published by the New England Journal of Medicine, AI Journal, that showed the real-world deployment of clinical AI tools. If we look across the US landscape right now, this particular technology is the second most utilized technology in the whole medical AI right now. So I think using this as an example is a good leeway into the whole medical AI ecosystem. So we first started doing this in 2020. And the idea is that everyone with diabetes should get an eye exam once a year. And the reason is that diabetic retinopathy is the leading cause of blindness in the working age population around the world and expected to get worse because of the rising incidence of diabetes. It's a very well-studied condition where we know if we screen patients with diabetes once a year, take a look at the retina and find and then treat the patients who need to be treated early, this is very good for the patient. It prevents blindness, and it's one of the most cost-effective way to prevent blindness on a population level. However, the issue is that even in the US, typically only about 50% of patients undergo this recommended screening once a year. So the screen rate is very low, and this number is even lower in countries around the world. So this is where autonomous AI comes in. In the old days, the way it works is you go see your primary care doctor, yeah, and then that doctor gives you, for example, insulin for your diabetes, check your blood pressure. But in order for your eyes to be checked, you need to make a separate appointment to go see your eye doctor, which, of course, yeah, creates friction and barrier. What autonomous AI does is that now we're doing the screening in a primary care office. So imagine you go see your doctor, get your blood pressure checked, get your medication refills. On the spot, you can get pictures of your retina taken by a camera. These images then get analyzed in real time by an AI model that sits on the cloud. And within a minute or so, the AI model will be able to determine autonomously, meaning without intervention from humans, whether you have diabetic retinopathy. If the answer is yes, then you should really get a more detailed checkup at an ophthalmologist's office. But if no, you're done with your screening for the year and you just get it screened again, you know, next year. We started doing this at Johns Hopkins Medicine in 2020, and we have been able to look back at our data and we asked ourselves, deploying AI technology sounds good, but did it do anything? Did it actually improve the metrics that, yes, we care about? And the answer is yes. So a few highlights there. We demonstrated that the deployments of autonomous AI for diabetic retinopathy screening was associated with improvement in adherence to this recommended annual screening. When we dove a little bit deeper and look at the patient subgroups, we recognized that the patient subgroups that benefited the most were African Americans and patients covered by Medicaid, meaning these are historically really disadvantaged patients, and we saw really outsized positive impacts in these populations. And we published our findings in Nature Digital Medicine about a year ago. So that's the first clinical example I can give. The second example is completely different. It has nothing to do with clinical medicine. It has more to do with the operational side of things, which is specifically using generative AI for revenue cycle management. Mm-hmm. And for those who may not be familiar with revenue cycle management, in a nutshell, that's how providers, especially complicated integrated health systems such as Johns Hopkins, that's how we get paid for the service that we provide. There's a lot of steps involved, a lot of paperwork involved. And historically, there's been a lot of effort in trying to automate some of this process using various kinds of old machine learning techniques, specifically called robotic process automation, where these machine learning techniques are very robotic. You need to write a lot of decision trees, and they're really not very good at handling exceptions. And this is where generative AI, especially when it comes to LLMs, are good at, like, really adaptive, inherently understands text information really well, specifically handles unstructured information really well. We have demonstrated that by deploying Gen AI for revenue cycle management, specifically for prior authorization, it's a lot more efficient, and we are able to decrease the amount of time needed for each prior authorization to be completed and submitted. So these are two very specific and real life examples that we're doing in Johns Hopkins Medicine right now.
That's very interesting. So I have just some curious questions, Alvin, on the first example that you talked about in the primary care physician setting that a patient can go and get their eyes checked. So does it need specialized equipment at this time? Do you think at some point in time, it may be that I can just use my iPhone camera and or look into some kind of a kiosk and, you know, kind of get it done at the airport? Or, you know, I always look into this when I do the security clearance, I look into Clear.
That's a great question. So I think you're hitting on a very important point, which is all the nuts and bolts that are involved in implementation. And implementation is very important when it comes to scaling any kind of technology, including AI technology. So the short answer is yes, you do need some specialized equipment, but these are very, very common. So in a nutshell, you need a way to take a picture of the back of the eye. And this is what we call a fundus camera. And broadly speaking, these are very common equipment that ophthalmologists use already, and there are many different brands, many different models, meaning if you take a step back, there's already a whole supply chain, a whole industrial process in producing these cameras. Now, the traditional ones are the ones that sort of sit on your desktop. They are not very portable in the sense that it's a little bit heavy. You can't just carry them yourselves. But at the same time, the footprint, we're talking about probably 2 feet times 2 feet, and you can put a camera on a just like small mobile table. So those are very easily accessible, and the quality, it really is quite good. Of course, we've been trying to come up with portable cameras, and a lot of these portable cameras do exist. And if you go even a little bit smaller, as you know, you can put an adapter on your smartphone and take a picture of your retina too. So all those technologies do exist. But if you look at what's happening in the real world, the vast majority of these AI models for diabetic retinopathy and others based on retinal images, do we indeed require the most common kind of desktop-based fundus cameras? Because these, although they're on the bigger side, do tend to take better quality images. And that's the why.
That's great. And then the curious question on the prior auth side is that, are you implementing and experimenting with prior auth across the board, or is it for certain set of disease conditions, EPT codes? And then is that a software that the team has developed, or is it something that you're using from the outside in?
That's a great question. So what you're getting at is like the nuances between the different service lines of which would benefit from prior authorization or not.
Yeah.
I think if you take a step back, broadly speaking, there are certain fields that require a lot of prior authorization, and that's how insurance payers do utilization management. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm painting very broad strokes here. Mm-hmm. Typically, the service lines or the medical specialties, they require typically give out more expensive treatments when it comes to medications, such as infusion medication, when it comes to oncology, or some of the dermatology medications that's on the expensive side. Or for us, retina, we do a lot of injections into the eye, what we call intravitreal injections for diabetes and age-related macular degenerations. These are some examples where since the treatment we are giving out on the expensive side, these are also typically the kind of service lines or medical specialties that will require prior authorization. So when we did our pilot at Hopkins, we did focus more on specialties that require a lot more prior authorizations versus some other ones that typically just go straight through and you don't need any prior authorization. But that's a great question. And it gets to the point where the devil is really in the detail. So even for a relatively specific step in the revenue cycle management, which is prior authorization, how you design a pilot that makes sense to demonstrate ROI, to establish the relevant KPIs, all this requires very deep understanding of how medicine works and operates, but not like in a vacuum.
Yeah, sure. So shifting gears a bit, Alvin, with the macroeconomic factors which are now impacting the whole ecosystem, including, you know, digital health and healthcare, which is a very large part of the US economy as we all know it. What are some of the things that you feel are in the upcoming scenario?
I'll answer this question from two opposite ends of the spectrum. First, more from the startup angle. In my role at Hopkins, and you know, I do end up interacting a lot with startup companies in the big AI space. And then I'll then answer the question on the opposite end, which is on the enterprise level.
Yes.
So on the startup side, I think one of the common mistakes that startup companies make in the healthcare AI space is not considering or not understanding the reimbursement issue from day one. And I think that's the most important thing. One could argue that, you know, healthcare AI is still a very new field. So payment mechanism in the market is not mature enough to handle an influx of new products. Mm-hmm. And in general, I think it's a very tough situation for healthcare AI startups because, first of all, if you belong to a founding team that has limited understanding of how medicine works, you probably don't understand CPT codes. You don't understand that, like, that's how things get paid, or that's one of the main ways to get paid. If you want to get a CPT code, very likely the vast majority of AI-enabled medical devices fall under the purview of the FDA. And if you want to get FDA approval, we're talking about $3 to $5 million off the bat. So one of the mistakes that I see startups make will, they're hyper-focused in building products in terms of the execution and also in terms of how they use the money without accounting for or budgeting for what's needed for the FDA approval, which is, you know, at least $3 to $5 million. And even if you are lucky enough to get FDA clearance for your medical AI device, then you have to think about, are there existing CPT codes that can actually reimburse you for the AI service that you are going to provide?
Right.
And the tricky thing is, like, if very likely there is not an existing CPT code that can fit the AI service, so then now you have to go negotiate with the AMA to get you a new applicable CPT code. And that process takes a long time. And even if you can get a new CPT code to fit your service, there's no guarantee that the payers are willing to pay for it. And even if you get the payers to pay for it, it may not be at a level that's financially sustainable. So I think from the startup perspective, one has to really think long and hard about the reimbursement pathway. Now, of course, one can be paid via other ways, not just CPT code, but that requires, again, very deep understanding of the business models of medicine. And oftentimes, you may need to come up with new business models that are not dependent on CPT in order to be financially sustainable from a startup perspective. Now, from the enterprise level and from a much broader picture is AI is here to stay. But I think from a health system perspective, it's a very chaotic scene. Every day, we as an integrated health system get many, many sales calls from many, many AI companies trying to sell us something, right? So it's a very chaotic scene. And that's why a robust AI governance structure that considers multiple aspects of this is sorely needed. And I think Johns Hopkins Medicine is one of the first major integrated health systems that has given this a lot of thought. Obviously, it's an evolving process and we are also learning from it. And I'm sure we're going to talk a little bit about that. So I think having a robust and industry-friendly also AI governance system is very critical. And you take even a step back on a very, very macro level, the billion-dollar question is, how's value-based medicine and artificial intelligence coming together? Because these are two very big trends that are going to happen, and they will intersect at some point very soon. What is that intersection looks like? I think it's going to be very interesting.
That's very good insight, Alvin. So could you talk to us about any digital health programs that have been implemented and that you have been involved with, which improve access to care, or any other examples that you would like to bring on the digital health program side of things?
The example that I would give is the autonomous AI for diabetic retinopathy screening program. That's a good example. We already talked a little bit about it. What we did learn is, you know, again, like, 80% of successful program, it's all about implementation and how you execute things. So for example, even if you have a successful screening program at the level of the primary care, you still have to figure out how to get the patients who screen positive to ophthalmologists. So that's a completely different line of work. And you can extend this analogy to other aspects as well. For example, in oculomics, and again, this is a topic that we can talk more about, just to set the stage, oculomics is a relatively new field of study that associates and connects biomarkers found in the eye. And for the most part, we mean retinal biomarkers with systemic health state. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Like right now, we can already use retinal images as input paired with AI and being able to predict someone's future cardiovascular risk, future risk and having kidney damage, and even dementia. So I think diabetic retinopathy is just an early example. We are going to see this explosion in adoption of oculomics. But the question is, okay, even if you can have this AI-based oculomics screening program in a community in primary care, and you end up identifying patients at risk for a variety of systemic conditions, such as Alzheimer's and cardiovascular diseases, what do you do afterwards? How do you set up a new workflow to get these people to the subspecialists that they need to see downstream? And that's in the works, is very fluid. But I think that kind of thinking and being able to implement things and execute things at scale efficiently, it's going to determine the success of a lot of AI programs, especially when it comes to AI oculomics program.
Yes, that's amazing. So Alvin, we talked about governance a bit. So how do you do your structuring of the organization, prioritization and funding, and what kind of operating models do you look at?
Sure, I'm happy to talk a little bit about that. I'll take a step back and give you just a very brief background. How this all came about. So back in 2024, so last year, the executive leadership of Johns Hopkins Medicine started a task force to develop an implementation strategy that ensures Johns Hopkins Medicine becomes a global leader in the responsible use of AI. One of the key tenets that this task force identified was that they wanted this to be a clinically led responsible AI program, meaning physicians like myself will and should play a major role. This task force then identifies seven core principles that are critical for responsible AI, which include fairness, transparency, accountability, ethical data use, safety, evidence-based effectiveness. And from these seven core principles, we identified several implementation plans. And a key implementation plan is to establish a governance process and framework that will be integrated with existing governance structure. And as a result, an AI oversight team was created. This team is an 8-person leadership team drawn from across the health system. I'm one of the 8 people, and we have purview over all things AI related across the health system in the imaging, clinical, and operational domains. And in a nutshell, what we have developed is a standardized framework for how AI vendors should interact with Johns Hopkins Medicine. So for example, if you have clinical AI products, you want to engage with Johns Hopkins Medicine, there's a standardized intake process where first you have to find an internal partner at Johns Hopkins Medicine that will be partnering with you and advocate for you. We have some standardized questionnaires asking, what is the tool used for? Do you have data card available? Do you have model cards available? What's the expected ROI? How do you demonstrate that it's safe, et cetera? Mm-hmm. AI then asked to answer these questions. And then depending on the nature of the tool, whether it's for operational versus clinical versus purely imaging, then this application gets advanced to different sub-teams. And then there will be an internal review committee to really do a deep dive on the answers provided by the vendor to the specified questions. We'll grade them and then bring them back to the committees and debate. And then oftentimes, this is an interactive process. We then we'll go back to the vendor and say, these are our concerns, or can you please clarify these things? And ultimately, the committee would do an up and down vote based on a variety of criteria and say, yes, this can be implemented at scale at enterprise level, or no, for these reasons. So that's what we established so far.
That's very robust process, Alvin. So thank you for sharing such good examples and, you know, thoughts and advice so far. Any final closing comments? I think we are coming to our end of our conversation. Any other things that you would like to bring up? Any announcements, news items, or anything else that you would like to share that's upcoming on your horizon?
What I would say is, at a very high level, I think the vast majority of people will agree that AI will change medicine and society as we know it. The train has left the station. Yeah. I don't think it's a debate right now whether we're going to go back. The question is, what's the future is going to look like? If we think specifically about healthcare, it's one of the most heavily regulated space across industries. And also, to a certain extent, it's very personal. Ultimately, we're in the process, we're in the business of taking care of people and reducing suffering. So there's very much a human nature and emotional component to it as well. I do think for the good of humanity, there should be more collaboration happening in this space. And specifically, I really do see that venture capital and startups will be a major engine of innovation. What has been lacking, although it's improving, is a very tight connection and collaboration between a VC startup world and integrated health systems. Yeah. And I think that should and need to be improved. Because ultimately, if you look in the US, integrated health systems deliver the majority of the healthcare in this country. So whether VCs and startups like it or not, their end products will have to go through enterprises and will have to go through integrated health systems where the majority of healthcare is delivered. However, at the same time, I think because of a variety of complex reasons, integrated health systems don't move as fast as industry. And I think integrated health systems also could improve on the way that decisions are made, specifically the speed of the decisions. Because as you look at the upward exponential curve of technology overall, and definitely for AI technology, things happen really fast and for good reasons. So I think both on the VC startup side and the integrated health system side, improvements can be made. And what I'm hoping to see is a much more robust and close collaboration between these seemingly different worlds in the near future. I think if that happens, ultimately, a lot of good will come out of this.
That's great to know. Thank you so much, Alvin. We are coming to the close of the podcast. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Rohit, for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation too.
Awesome.